Well, our next Reasons to Believe book is this one, Creationist Science. I could send it around the class, but it wouldn't help you. Any of the insides are an accounting book. This is just the cover of the book. But I think it may get released early. They're talking about an August 22nd release date. So, right. Yeah, the insides have nothing to do with creation or science. You're right. So, that's true. That's true. Okay. Before we attempt to finish up our study on general revelation, I want to alert you to five papers that have been published in the astronomical literature. And this is probably the record for papers that have been published in a one-week window. And these five papers are all about discoveries of complex molecules in the interstellar medium. And it's generated by an announcement in the Astrophysical Journal last year that they have had to withdraw the claim that they had found an amino acid in the interstellar medium and a nucleic base in the interstellar medium. For about 10 years now, it's been on record that astronomers have discovered glycine, the simplest of the 20 biological amino acids. I forget how many molecules or atoms in it. I think it's like 9 or 10 atoms in the glycine molecule. But last year, they claimed that they had misidentified the spectral lines, and therefore glycine is on record as not being detected anywhere outside of planet Earth. So, and likewise, in the same time window, they announced that the nucleic base that they had said they had discovered, nucleic bases are kind of the fundamental molecules that make up RNA and DNA. They also had to withdraw that claim. They had misidentified the spectral lines. Well, what's happened in the meantime in the last year is there's been a furious effort to look at these interstellar clouds, which are really the only place in the universe that you're going to have any hope of finding either the sugars that make up life or the nucleic bases or the amino acids. And, you know, last year they had a total of 122 carbon-based molecules that they discovered. These five papers are announcing six more carbon-based molecules that have been discovered. However, the entire list are either two carbon molecules or three carbon molecules. And the problem there is that the simplest of the sugars that make up RNA and DNA are 5 and 6 carbon sugars. And the hope was that they'd be able to find something like that, but still no pentose sugars have been discovered anywhere in the interstellar medium. So why are the sugars important? The sugars are what join the nucleic bases together to make the DNA and the RNA. Without the sugars, you're not going to be able to pull these things together. And so it still stands on record, in spite of all this effort to find these molecules, that they have yet to discover any of the fundamental building blocks that make up the molecules of life, namely the proteins, the DNA, and the RNA. Well, they've withdrawn the claim for glycine, and these five papers are all an attempt to find complex carbon molecules, and what they announce is molecules that they were searching for that had more than three carbon molecules they could not find, and they found the 2 and 3 carbon molecules at very low abundance levels. Now, if Fuzz were here, he could explain to you the chemistry of why this really isn't a very good hope of finding these things in these interstellar clouds. The reason being is that you've got a low-temperature environment. In a low-temperature environment, I'm talking between 10 and 30 degrees above absolute zero. You say, well, what's absolute zero? That's about 460 degrees below zero. We were just talking before the break about how I've had friends in Canada that catch fish in the wintertime, and when they pull a fish out of the ice, it freezes before they can get it into there. That's what happens when it's 70 below zero. Your fish actually freezes before you can take it from the water and put it in your ice chest. Not that you need an ice chest. So, and it stays frozen until you thaw it out at home. But this is 460 degrees. Well, actually, we're talking between 420 and 450 degrees below zero. And that's an ideal temperature to get these kinds of 2 and 3 carbon complex molecules to come together. But it's not a good chemical environment for pulling together the amino acids the nucleobases, and especially the sugars. The sugars require a warmer condition. The other problem is that ultraviolet radiation works to pull these molecules together, but it also works to destroy the more complex carbon-based molecules. And so even if you were to produce any glycine, it would be immediately destroyed by the ultraviolet radiation that exists there in the environment. Now, the bad news for origin of life researchers coming from a naturalistic perspective, as we've already demonstrated, that origin of life chemistry can't happen here on Earth, and if it can't happen outside of Earth, then that means you don't have any naturalistic pathway to make it happen. And as one researcher pointed out, even if we were to find a sugar, a pentose sugar, or one of the amino acids or nucleobases, our search for these things have already told us if they exist, they exist at parts per billion or less. And at parts per billion or less, they're totally useless to help the origin of life problem. You have to have these molecules in concentration. Parts per billion simply won't help. So in that sense, we already know the answer. If they do exist, they're at parts per billion or less, and they're parts per billion or less. This provides no hope for origin of life from a naturalistic perspective, which leaves you with what? Origin of life from a supernatural perspective. Okay. Now, we'll probably be talking about that in Creation Update. Some of you asked me questions about Stephen Hawking's latest paper that he has published. It's all over the web. It's a little on the complex side. I will talk about it on Creation Update on Tuesday, so you can either listen to it live between 11 and 1, or you can listen to it on offline. We post all the shows on our website, and you can download them into your iPods and listen to them that way. So, but bottom line, I'll tell you, is that he's trying to, in a very subtle way, revive the multiverse hypothesis by claiming that quantum mechanics will automatically produce all these different universes with different conditions. So it's really a philosophical paper, not an astrophysical paper. But I'll talk about it on Creation Update. If you really want to see the paper, I actually got it here. It's got a great title, Populating the Landscape, a Top-Down Approach. So, okay, you can check that out. Let's just jump into our discussion on Is Nature's Record Reliable? And let me just jump right to the scripture verses that we're studying. Here we go. This is the introduction. Let's see if we can get past that. And here we go. Here's our list of verses on general revelation that we've been studying. If you're wondering where we are in our creation text, it's in Psalm 19. We'll be looking at Psalm 33 next. And some of the passages we've already studied in past weeks, the one in Job 12, ask the animals and they'll teach you, or the birds of the air and they'll tell you, or speak to the earth and they'll teach you, and let the fish of the sea inform you. And we had a good time talking about exactly how animals, birds, and fish and the earth actually do speak to us about God and his plan of salvation. When I consider the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you've set in place, what is man that you're mindful of him? We spent a couple of weeks studying Psalm 8, and the entire psalm is filled with how God speaks his message of humility through the record of nature. This is just one example. It also talks about how God proclaims his message of coming to him through humility, through little children, and also makes mention of the animals in that respect. So look at the psalm. Every theme in the psalm is focusing on the point of humility, and the background scripture verse for that is that God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humility. But we were talking earlier, just Ross and I, about, you know, these amazing discoveries and, you know, what kind of impact is this going to have? We were talking about all the evidence, for example, in creationist science and making the point, yeah, it will convert scientists who are not proud. Okay? A proud scientist will not be converted. That a proud janitor won't be converted. Pride will block anyone from coming to faith in Christ. So the first step is one of humility, and that's the point of Psalm 8. Psalm 19, the psalm we're in, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. There is no speech or language where their voice is not heard, their words go to the ends of the world. And as we discussed, this is where the Belgic Confession. One of the great confessional statements of the Reformation gets its doctrinal platform that God has given us two books. He's given us the Bible, the words of the Bible, but he's also spoken and written a message on the heavens that everyone can read. And the word of the Lord is right and true. He is faithful in all he does. God is no less faithful in what he has revealed through the record of nature than what he has revealed in the words of the Bible. It's the same God that can't lie, and therefore what he reveals to us in nature is just as trustworthy and reliable as what he reveals to us in the Bible. The word of the Lord, probably the heavens proclaim his righteousness. And I made the point last week that actually there are more verses in the Bible talking about how the heavens proclaim the righteousness of God than there are verses that proclaim the glory of God. And we had fun with this one. They who dwell in the ends of the earth stand in awe of your signs. Psalm 65, verse 8. And I was reminded this isn't exactly how the New International Version pulls it. I forget which version I took this from. I think the New International Version uses in awe of your wonders rather than awe of your signs. So you can put that down if you're taking notes. But the point here is that the record of nature seems to speak most loudly and clearly to those who do not have a context with the Bible or the Christian faith. The point of this Psalms is contrasting the reaction of the Jews to what God reveals through nature compared to the non-Jews. And it says those who dwell in the ends of the earth are the ones that are most impressed with God's miracles. And I think the fun thing we had last week, I counted 11 people in the class who have gone overseas to do missionary work, either short-term or long-term. And how every one of you testified how when you go overseas and talk to people that are far removed from the Christian faith, you find that there are no atheists. They all believe in God. And they believe in God because of what they've seen in nature. They're closer to the land. I appreciate our missionary that had spent all those years in Bolivia making a comment that because the Bolivians are on the land, they have no doubt in the existence of God. His people live in the big cities that have the problem. And I think that's true here in America as well. You're much more likely to find atheists and agnostics living in the downtown cores of our large cities than you are, say, out in the cornfields of Indiana. The heavens praise your wonders, O Lord. This is a new passage for us. And by the way, when we get into the new stuff, what I want you to do as a class is to tell me what you think this passage is telling us about general revelation. The heavens praise your wonders, O Lord, your faithfulness too. I think we covered this one, right? This one we talked about how God is immutable, he's consistent, he is utterly dependable. The heavens praise your wonders, O Lord, and your dependability as well. We can count on it. This is a new one. The heavens proclaim his righteousness, and all the peoples see his glory. Now, when it talks about the heavens declaring his righteousness, exactly what do you think that's trying to imply? Anyone? This always happens when I talk too fast in the intro, but go ahead. Yeah. He makes it rain on the just and the unjust. You know, God isn't impartial here, or partial. He does proclaim his righteousness to all, the wicked as well as the virtuous. So, anything else? I saw a hand over here. Yes, Bertrand. Well, that's exactly the question I was asking. What is righteous in the way God creates the universe? And exactly what does this text mean when it says the heavens proclaim his righteousness? I mean, I tried this on my son's friends. As I hear all these passages, it says the heavens declare the righteousness of God. What does that mean? Good question. Yes. All right. Kind of picking up on the last verse, we saw how God is immutable and dependable. He's got laws out there that never seem to be violated. As we look at the record of nature, there are no exceptions. It's not like where you get caught by a policeman when you have a traffic violation. Sometimes you can talk your way out of it. there's no talking your way out of the law of gravity. It's going to do things to you, whether you like it or not. And there's no negotiation going on here. But I think that we're talking not just about physical laws, but other kinds of laws as well. And how does that come through nature? I mean, isn't it Campus Crusade? It says there are laws of physics and there are spiritual laws as well. What about these spiritual laws? How evident are they through the record of nature, and what can we learn about them? And what does it tell us about the righteousness of God? I got a whole bunch more passages coming up on this. It's interesting how the Old Testament just makes these generic statements, and the New Testament actually explicitly tells us exactly what this text means about the righteousness of God. But any thoughts before we actually get to those New Testament passages? Yes, Jackie. Yeah, I think so. I mean, you've got a point there, is that there's a reason why God has us live for a few decades on this planet, because over the course of a few decades, you do get to see the immutability and the dependability of both the physical laws and the spiritual laws. And the spiritual laws tell us a lot of things about the universe, about God, and about us. Okay? Well, he definitely is, and one thing that comes through from an astrophysical perspective is all this is created just for us. There's really no other purpose for God creating the universe than to create a home for us, a place for us, and then a righteous path for us. So in that sense, I think the heavens do declare the righteousness of God. It's not just God creating a home for us, it's creating a pathway whereby we can gain righteousness, yes. Well, you mentioned some very provocative things in your comment, Ross, about how, you know, when you look at the universe, there's something about the universe that guides us along that path. You know, and exactly what is that? And you also mentioned how there's this morality that's out there. Well, I consider this part of general revelation. It's not in the stars and galaxies. But isn't it interesting that in every human heart, there is a moral ethic? And that moral ethic is identical. There's a reason why all the religions of the world contain the elements of the Ten Commandments. As it tells us in Romans 2, God has written His law on the heart of every human being. What's general revelation? I mean, you can talk to any human being and you'll be able to ferret out that moral ethic. It's there. And that must tell us something about God. And then you look at the physics. I mean, if you go back to Genesis 3, what does it tell us there? The moment that Adam and Eve fell into sin and rebellion against God, they were cursed. Well, what was the curse? They were separated from God. There was going to be weeds and thorns and thistles, pain and childbirth, and what was the other thing? Suffering and work. Right. And what does this say explicitly about the pain and the work? More pain and more work. Did Adam and Eve experience work before they sinned against God? Yes, they did. Did they experience pain before they rebelled against God? Yes, they did. So what happened after they sinned was more pain and more work. Well, here's a question I want to ask you. Is there something about the universe that inherently makes that happen? Yeah, entropy, exactly. Okay, can you tell the class what you mean by that? For those that may not fully appreciate that term. Right. So it takes work to reverse the effects of the law of decay. Romans 8 tells us that God had built the law of decay into the universe, and the entire universe is subject to the law of decay until what time? That's what's interesting about Romans 8. It tells us the law of decay has been ruling the universe from the time it was created, but it won't rule it forever. There's an event in the future which will stop the law of decay. Now, new heavens and the new earth. And what happens just before the new heavens and the new earth? Yeah, the universe is destroyed. The universe will fulfill its purpose. And why will the universe fulfill its purpose? Rolled up like a scroll, but I mean, what we could do if we wanted to, there are about 15 different places in the Bible that talk about the end of the universe. And it uses words like disappear, vanish. And what it tells us in Revelation 21 is that as God spoke the universe into existence, I think our next passage, creation text, is going to talk about that. Psalm 33, Psalm 65, how God, through His spoken word, brought the universe into existence, but a time will come when He will speak it out of existence and replace it with a brand new universe. So it's not a transformed universe, it's a replaced universe. But what key event generates the removal of the universe and its replacement by the new creation? That's it. Evil is gone. Yeah, you got one right. Well, I think we're moving forward now in this passage about righteousness here. In other words, as we look at the physics of the universe and see how it works, it tells us that God's got a plan and operation to remove evil once and for all. And that we can see through the record of nature, that gives us some hope that God has actually got a plan of salvation for us. When we look at the book of Job, we're going to actually see how Job was able to deduce that from a study of the record of nature. But that was kind of the beginning, that we have the universe set out there in such a way that it brings about certain responses to our sin and evil. I mean, you made the comment that entropy causes things to become more disorganized. However, the more evil we human beings behave, the more rapidly things become disorganized. And so things are going to get disorganized and chaotic and decayed all by themselves. I mean, if you do nothing, if you're perfectly virtuous, things will still decay. But there is a way you can speed the decay up. And that's by having sinful behavior. And that extra decay that's the result of your sin and evil means what? I think we put it, say, you've got to do more work to reverse the effects of the decay, extra decay that was generated by your evil. As it is, you've got to work. That's why Adam had to work in the garden. The garden was decaying. God had intended the garden to sustain it. But once he committed rebellion against God, now he had a lot more to do to sustain that garden and keep it in a pristine condition. Yes. Right, right. Very good. I like that one. Yes. I think there's a lot that testifies to his goodness and character. I think that's what's coming out here. This is kind of the first introduction as we get into these passages about, you know, how we can reveal, understand things about God's character as we look at the record of nature. But I want to push this theme a little bit further that we've been talking about, how, you know, there is this decay in the universe. And the decay is simply the direct result of the way the laws of physics have been structured. Gravity causes things to decay. Electromagnetism causes things to decay. All the laws of physics work to bring about decay. And they work to bring about decay at a fairly rapid rate. But it's interesting how the rate at which things progress towards decay, and by the way, the universe is extremely efficient at generating decay. Very efficient. But the level of efficiency is ideal to restrain the expression of human evil and sin. And if we're any greater, we would all be discouraged and give up on life. I mean, if things decayed just at a phenomenal rate, why bother doing any work at all? But it's also at a high enough level that we appreciate how the sin and evil we commit just makes life a lot more miserable for us. You got to do more work, and you experience more pain. And therefore, you're motivated because none of us like... So, by the way, there's three consequences. When you sin, you generate more work to reverse the effects of the law of decay. You experience more pain into trying to reverse the effects of the law of decay. And you waste time. You waste time, more pain, more work. Well, the thing that's interesting about the way God has structured us human beings, we don't like to see our time wasted. And we don't like to experience extra pain, and we don't like extra work, which is something that every parent here in the room has understood. If you want to discipline your children, there are three ways to discipline your children. Bring more pain into their life, give them more work to do, or cause their time to be wasted. Or do all three. I mean, whatever works, right? Now, what's interesting about this, as human authorities, that's the technique we use. We rein in the evil of those under our authority by measuring out pain and work and wasted time, hopefully commensurate to the amount of unacceptable behavior that we've been observing. I mean, that's what wise parents try to do. That's what the police try to do. That's what the government tries to do. Now, all authority, teachers and working with their students, that's the technique that we use. And, you know, we try to do the best we can. What if we, as an authority figure, a parent or a teacher or a cop or a government official, fails to exercise that kind of discipline and those under their authority? What happens then? And who suffers? Well, I'm talking about the authority figure. Isn't it interesting that if the human authorities fail to exercise more pain, more work, or wasted time on those that are violating standards of behavior, they wind up with experiencing more pain, more work, and wasted time? I find that as a powerful motivator as a father, that if I don't discipline my sons in a manner that God wants me to discipline them, my time gets wasted. If they don't clean up their room, I got to clean up their room. That's wasted time for me. And it's also very painful. So I'm motivated to try to get them to go through that, and if they don't, then I will discipline them accordingly. Now, Job actually comments on how amazing it is that the universe is structured in such a way that it motivates human authorities to exercise discipline to rein in sin and evil, and it motivates us as individuals to do likewise. So when you say the heavens proclaim the righteousness of God, it seems like there's a God out there that's really intent on trying to restrain the expression of human evil and human sin, which means that this is a God that must have some vested interest in seeing that this evil be dealt with appropriately. And he's placed within us a hope that this will actually be removed. I mean, we talk about how God has written his law in his heart. He's also written something else in our heart. He's written upon our heart a hope for some kind of final destiny and purpose and deliverance from the situation we're facing. And, you know, if there was no God, why do all of us have this? In fact, I've been reading some of the atheist literature this past week. They've got now three humanist manifestos, and then they got a list of what they call attributes from the humanist manifesto. What I find interesting is it reveals this human commonality of pursuing some kind of ultimate hope. I mean, why would an atheist have that? Why would atheists express that? If there is no God, forget it. There is no hope. And yet we see this in all of their writings. And I think what this reveals is simply that just like God has written his law upon the heart of every human being, he's also placed within this yearning, this hope for some kind of ultimate destiny and deliverance from our current situation. So in that sense, I think the heavens really do proclaim the righteousness of God. Maybe not the specific plan of salvation, but certainly the elements that would cause us to start thinking at the next step. And then we have the second part of this verse. All the people see his glory. In other words, this is information, knowledge, that's made available to all. It's not just a select few that get to see the righteousness of God. If anyone is humble enough, it's quite evident that the universe has been structured in such a way to deal with the problem of human evil. And therefore, that should give us hope, and that tells us there must be a glorious God out there. All the peoples have seen this, and therefore, we are without excuse. There is a righteous plan for humanity that's out there. Any more comments? I think I saw a hand somewhere on this side of the room, but maybe not. Okay, moving on. Next passage. The Lord has made his salvation known and revealed his righteousness to the nations. All the ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. And this is in Psalm 98, where God again is reminding the Jews, look, you are my people, but you're not my only people. So any comments on what you think this passage is trying to communicate to us? Yeah, Bertrand? Well, again, there have been people in this class who've been to the ends of the earth. I spent a week in Mongolia a few years ago. And this is a nation where they didn't even know the name Jesus. They'd never heard of Moses. They never heard of David. They never heard of Jesus. They didn't know there was a Bible out there. But I tell you, it's a nation where there were no atheists. And it's a nation that had suffered a terrible persecution, first under the Buddhists, and then under the communists. In fact, what I found interesting is the Mongolians were telling me how when the Russians invaded and slaughtered all these people, it was actually a blessing in disguise because they were delivered from the oppression of the Buddhist priests. There were a few thousand Buddhist priests ruling the country, and it's a particular sect of Buddhism where the priests demanded the firstborn from every woman in the entire nation. And it caused disease to run through the nation. In fact, the population was in danger of extinction. The Russians came in 1919 and slaughtered all those Buddhist priests. And what I found when I went there a few years ago, they said that was the salvation of Mongolia. It says our population was heading down towards total extinction. And the Russian atrocities rescued us from the worst atrocities of these Buddhist priests. And so the nation was able to recover. But as a result, they said, you know, there must be a God out there that cares for us to deliver us, first from the Buddhists and then from the Russians. Because I came there just after the Russians had left. And when the Russians had left, they just felt this euphoria, and they said, God has something for us. We don't know what it is. And fortunately, missionaries began to come in and began to preach the gospel to them. So maybe that's some help there that... I think it applies to North Korea. I mean, the reason why I gave the example of Mongolia, it's a personal example I'm aware of, but as I traveled around the world, it's what you would think are the darkest, spiritually darkest places in the world where there's actually the greatest receptivity to the gospel. I think I mentioned last week how I'd been to this place in Africa, which was entirely Hindu, and it's one of the most incredible responses to the gospel I've ever seen in my life. And the reason why was the people in that part of the country had been raised as Hindus, but they knew through their Hindu upbringing that there was something wrong. I mean, what do Hindus teach? The universe is contradictory. It's chaotic. What do their eyes tell them? The universe is ordered and harmonious and is immutable. Things don't change. And they said what the Hindus taught us we knew was not right. This idea of reincarnation bothered them. And so he said, we knew what was not right, but we did not know, we knew what was wrong, but we didn't know what was right. So when I laid out the gospel, it's like there's just this huge response saying, that's it, that's what we've been looking for all of our lives. And I'm wondering if there are things going on in North Korea. I can tell you one other story. I was in the Soviet Union, was still run by the Soviets, and we ran into this woman that was from an oblast in a Muslim part of the Soviet Union that Western missionaries had presumed was 100% Muslim and totally closed to the gospel. And this woman was there to inform us that virtually the entire oblast had come to Christ, had left the Islamic faith and come to Christ. And we asked her, how did that happen? Trans World Radio. She says, you know, every time Trans World Radio would broadcast, we would all gather around our shortwave radios and listen. And then we would spread the message throughout our whole area. And that's one of the more dynamic Christian movements in the former Soviet republics today. So I don't know what's going on in North Korea, but it is interesting how God's light seems to penetrate the darkest of places. And maybe sometime we'll do this in a class. We've developed a message about how God communicates his divine light and glory through cosmic darkness, and how God purposely made the universe to be extremely dark. But by making it extremely dark, he made it possible for us to see the light of creation. And if it wasn't extremely dark, we wouldn't be able to see that. Well, I think there's a lesson that goes beyond that. God has his ways of bringing about his brightest light in the darkest places. So who knows what's going on in North Korea? Got a comment? Right. How about that? Higher percentage in North Korea than in South Korea. Of those who've gotten out, right. So in South Korea is one of the more Christian nations on the planet, so that's very interesting. Yeah, but I'll tell you, you're right about it being dark. In our office, we have this map that shows the world at night and shows all the lights, and the darkest spot on the planet is North Korea. Yeah. I mean, look at South Korea, just a big bright light. North Korea, nothing. Not even in the capital city. Well, yeah, it's extreme poverty and, you know, the government waste that's going on there where there just simply isn't electricity, so they just turn all the lights out. Not that they have a lot of lights to start with. So, yeah, North Korea really needs your prayers. I mean, it's a place where people are literally starving to death for no good reason. So, well, I mean, there are parts of Antarctica and Greenland that are just as dark as North Korea. But that's what's interesting. They're just as dark. I mean, North Korea is as dark as central Greenland, so that's pretty bad. All right. Any more comments on this passage? Okay, let's move on. The Lord made his salvation known, revealed his righteousness to the nations. The ends of the earth have seen the salvation of our God. So in answer to Bertrand's question, based on Psalm 98, the North Koreans have seen the salvation of our God. They may not have Bibles, but somehow they've seen it. And, you know, if you look for it, you can figure that out. I think this is even true of little children and severely retarded people. God has his way of getting his message across to him. He has made his salvation known and revealed not just his glory, but his righteousness to all the nations. In fact, it's interesting that sometimes it's more powerfully revealed than in places where God is preached daily and people are going to church all the time. How many are your works, O Lord? In wisdom you've made them all. The earth is full of your possessions. Psalm 104 is one of the creation texts we'll be studying in some detail. There's Psalm 104 is a passage of the Bible that takes you through the six creation days of Genesis 1. Only in quite a bit more detail than what you get in Genesis 1. So, by the way, if you ever run into some skeptic who doesn't like your interpretation of Genesis 1, you can always take him to Psalm 104. Psalm 104 is much more scientific detail, for example, than Genesis chapter 1. and will really facilitate a proper interpretation of Genesis chapter 1. But this is one of the statements in Psalm 104. How many are your works? In wisdom you've made them all. The earth is full of your possessions. I think some obvious points here, but what do you think? I'm thinking particularly of the skeptic who says, and you hear this all the time in the United States of America, I'm not a Christian, I'm not a believer, because there's not enough evidence. Okay? Have you ever heard that one? They'll admit there's some evidence, but they say the evidence is not adequate. I mean, that's even true of Stephen Hawking. He believes in God, but he says, I don't see adequate evidence that this God is Jesus Christ, and I need to submit my life to him. Well, what does this verse of Psalm 104 got to say about that? Okay, go ahead. Right. That's right. This is a summary passage, correct. So he says, and you know, with Psalm 104, he's just saying, look around. I mean, look at the springs, look at the donkeys. So, and therefore, what can we say to that skeptic? Yeah. Exactly. The evidence is there. That's the phrase that hits me. Is what Psalm 104 is telling us, not only has God revealed himself through nature, he's revealed himself in an overwhelming manner. The evidence is utterly overwhelming. And it takes extreme pride to say, I don't have adequate evidence. So when a skeptic says, I don't see adequate evidence, you know what a spiritual problem is. Yes. Right. Right. That's a very good example, Ross. The whole idea of the Pharisees and Sadducees coming to Jesus and saying, if your God perform miracles. And his response was, I already have. I've given you overwhelming evidence. And performing more miracles isn't going to help you. And likewise, God has revealed himself overwhelmingly through the record of nature. Yeah, John? Well, if you go to our website at reasons.org, we've got posted there the press release from Stephen Hawking, and then we've got a press release that responds to it. But in his press release, he says, we have to look for another planet because Earth isn't going to last much longer. I think he lists three problems. He says that global warming could clobber us, we could have nuclear war, or we could release a virus upon the population. So he looks at human activity as a making the planet. And I would agree with him that if it's not global warming, if it's not nuclear war, if it's not some kind of viral attack that gets loose from one of our labs, it'll be something else. If you leave humanity in the face of the earth long enough, they will do themselves in. In fact, I would argue that even our affluence and technology, if left to continue, will eventually do ourselves in. It has a dramatic impact on our DNA over a long period of time. I won't go into that right now, but it's kind of an interesting topic about how wealth and technology damages human DNA. But it takes about 1,000 years or so it's not something you have to worry about tomorrow. However, I can tell you that the next generation will be more genetically defective than the current generation. It's guaranteed in nations that have high technology and a high affluence. That's going to happen. So, you know, if Hawking, you might say, well, Hawking was quite ridiculous to mention these things, but I think he's in principle right. But we actually argue in our press release that it's much worse than what Hawking stated. Is that forget about human abuse and human evil. Just leave the solar system all by itself, and it will make the Earth uninhabitable. Within 10 million years, the sun will be too bright to sustain human beings on the planet. The sun gets brighter and brighter every year. And not that that explains the global warming situation we're facing now. It only gets brighter by a very tiny amount, but over the course of several million years, it makes a difference. And you say, well, can't we just take greenhouse gases of the atmosphere to compensate? 10 million years from now, in order to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere to compensate for the brighter sun, you'd have to take the carbon dioxide and water vapor levels down to a point where plants can't survive. And if plants can't survive, that has serious consequences on the survival of the human species, all life for that matter. So within 10 million years, we've got to find another planet. However, as I read my Bible, as I read these passages, God has a plan to fulfill his righteous goal for humanity in a lot less than 10 million years. And God's plan is that this universe is temporary. Well, the good news from Stephen Hawking's press release, I think he's alerting us to the fact that our salvation is at hand. It's not going to be a billion years from now. It's not going to be a few million years from now. It's going to be a lot less than that. And therefore, that's exciting news. Okay. Overwhelming evidence we see in the record of nature that there must be a super intelligent, supernatural being there that has created this Earth and the universe for the benefit of humanity and is created in such a way to deliver us from our unrighteous state. And hey, you've been coming to this class for the last several years. I think you've seen a little bit of that overwhelming evidence. In fact, it's so overwhelming that every day had reasons to believe we post a brand new scientific discovery that gives more proof for the wisdom of God, the creativity of God, the miraculous nature of God. That's how overwhelming it is. Every single day we can post a brand new scientific discovery. In fact, if we had the scientific staff, we could post 10 a day. So it really is overwhelming and becoming more so as time goes on. Okay, moving on. Ecclesiastes. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. Okay, any insights on what's going on in this passage? By the way, this is a theme, this particular set of verses for a book that was written by the missionary Don Richardson, Eternity in Their Hearts. He actually gives examples. Right. Okay, what does it mean when it says he set eternity in the hearts of men? He'll set up something. What does that tell us? I mean, we talk about a God who's written his law upon his heart. He's written hope upon his heart. This seems to indicate something else. What do you think? Yes. Right. Right. Well, you know, right now we're watching Kathy's mother go through her last days. But it's been fun just having conversations with her and just how eager she is to meet her loved ones that are already on the other side. She says, I know my brother's waiting for me, my sister's waiting for me, my mother and father are waiting for me. And she starts listing all of her friends. She's basically saying, I can't wait. And I know there's going to be a party when I get there. So, but there's something in our heart that makes us believe that. Yes. Man would not be surprised by the passing of time. Why? What was the last phrase? If he was not created for eternity. Very good. Yeah.
To me, it's a huge evidence that we're not related to obviously highly intelligent animals, I don't think we'd be concerned with it either. We'd just be doing what we do, and it wouldn't even be a thought.
Right. Well, that's an excellent point. I mean, this is unique to the human species. We are the only ones that have eternity written upon our hearts. We're the only ones that are worried, as you say, about the passage of time. Oh, I'm wasting time. I've got to do this. Now, as I look at my dog, that doesn't ever seem to be a concern in his life. Time management is not something he's concerned about. And yet that's a concern of every human being, even little children. You think children are just frittering away time, but it's not true. They're also concerned about time management, which is why they hate to clean their rooms, because they're concerned about what that means in terms of time they could be spent doing something else, and how worried they are when summer starts, because they know fall's coming very quickly. So, yeah. Okay, very good point. In other words, if you're going to dispute this and say there is no eternity in the heart of men, why do we fight so much to extend our life? And why are we so concerned what we do in our life that's going to last, quote, forever? Again, the animals don't worry about what they're passing on to their children or their offspring, what kind of heritage they're building for them, but that seems to be the concern of every human being as they get late in life. You know, what have I done that's going to last forever? Whereas the animals never worry about that. But I also think there's something in this text that's making it clear that every human being knows that they're going to live forever. There's something within each one of us that says this life isn't all there is, which I think is what makes the atheist, for example, fear death. He knows that with death, that's not it. There's more to come after death. Or as it says in John 16, everyone knows that judgment's coming. God has written that upon our hearts. It's not just the law that's there. We know we will be judged. And that's what makes us react to death so differently than the animals. The animals face death without any concern about judgment. You know, when the animals die, by the way, this is Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is also the book that makes the point. When animals die, they go to the dust. When humans die, their bodies go to the dust, but they continue to live. They will live on. So we're the one species on planet Earth that is created eternal, and according to this text and as other texts we see in the New Testament, every human being knows that they're eternal. The question is, where do you want to spend the rest of eternity? That's the choice that God is giving us. You have a choice to spend eternity with God or a choice to spend eternity without God. That's your choice. But based on your choice, that determines the living conditions in both places. So, yeah. Well, I think so. I mean, we've talked about how one of the ways God gets us to move away from evil behavior is through work. However, work was intended to be enjoyable. I mean, what makes the work... Because what it says in Genesis 3 is that because of Adam's sin, there would be toilsome labor. Okay, now the difference between toilsome labor and fulfilling labor is the fact that when you're wasting time and having to redo, I imagine gardening wouldn't be very much fun if you were not paying attention to the weeds, for example. You'd be planting all this stuff, and what you plant just wouldn't grow properly. If you don't fertilize it, it would die. And you say, I just seem to be planting this stuff over and over again. That's something that my wife goes through. She says, everything I plant dies. Well, after a while, you give up planting things, okay? That becomes toilsome labor. But, I mean, if you really know what you're doing, then you can actually get things to be productive. And so, I mean, this is what really makes murder such a horrible sin. You're stealing someone else's labor. Labor is intended to be productive and enjoyable. what makes labor non-productive and non-enjoyable would be the sin and evil in our life. Without that, it would be enjoyable. I think Adam really enjoyed his work. But once he rebelled against God, his work now became toilsome. It says, by the sweat of your brow, you will eat from the land. Well, the reason why he was sweating was because he was doing abusive things to the land, which meant he was doing way more work than he needed to work. And when you realize that, that suddenly gets you thinking, you know, maybe if I respond to the land in a less abusive way, I won't have to go through all this pain and suffering. And so again, it's the way God has designed the universe and the laws of physics in such a way as to encourage us to move in that direction. And also, I think, to discover we can't do it on our own. Well, I think we are, and we're also living in a country where there isn't quite the abuse of the land that goes on in other nations. I mean, you look at Egypt, for example. And that Aswan Dam they put up just ruined the country and brought disease. And now it's very difficult for them to raise their crops and keep the population healthy because of the way they abuse the water from the Nile. I mean, you know, what we learn in history as little kids, how the Nile was a gift to Egypt, but the Egyptians under Nasser ruined that special gift. And that's a good example. When it was American agriculturalists who told Nasser, don't put that dam up. And they gave him a number of reasons of what would happen if they put that dam up. He says, you'll get short-term benefit, but it'll be a long-range catastrophe. And indeed, it was a short-range benefit. The food supply of Egypt tripled in the first few years. But now that dam has been in place long enough where they're seeing the consequences that the American engineers warned them of. Not that we've always been perfect in the way we manage our land either, but right. It is an interesting question, but based on what we've been studying here, we could conclude that our management of the planet would be very fulfilling and enjoyable work for us to do. It would be exciting in terms of what we'd be able to learn. I mean, I find it interesting that one of the things God said in Genesis 1, multiply and fill the earth. If you're going to manage this planet, you're going to need help. You're going to need lots of people. And I find it interesting that even with 6 billion people on the face of the earth, we still don't know all the species of life that exist on the planet. I mean, I think if you were put in charge of the planet, the first thing you want to do is inventory the resources of the planet. Well, I find it fascinating. We've only inventoried 25% of all the life forms on planet Earth. So it's like step one of managing the planet that was told to us in Genesis 1 has yet to be achieved. And I think that's even built into when God says to Adam in Genesis 2, name all the animals. That's step one. I mean, Adam hadn't sinned yet. He was given the command to manage the planet for the benefit of all life. And isn't it interesting that God first has him work the land so he understands how plants are the base of the food chain, and he has them name all the animals that are in the garden. Well, I think this is an example for humanity. I mean, in terms of managing the planet, the first thing you want to do is look at the botany. Get the plants going in an appropriate way. Then you want to inventory the animals. Then you want to exercise a wise management program of the resources in the crust of the earth. And I find in the 21st century, we're still not there yet. Not even close. Yes. Well, you're correct. That would be impossible if that indeed was the case. But what does it tell us in Genesis 1? For 6 days God created, on the seventh day he stopped creating. We're in that day of rest where God does not create. So ever since God created Eve, there's been no new species of life appear on the earth. I mean, That was a huge step in my coming to faith in Christ, was reading Genesis 1 and trying to figure out. I mean, ever since I was 10 years old, I've been bothered by this enigma. We see speciation in the past, we see extinction in the past, we see extinction today, but we see no speciation. How do you explain that? And as I read the evolutionary arguments for it, I said, they don't offer any explanation. They can explain the extinctions, they can't explain the speciation, and they can't explain why we see no speciation events today. But Genesis 1 offers an explanation. For 6 days, God creates. Those are the speciation events. On the seventh day, he stops. We're still in the seventh day, and because we're still in the seventh day, we're in that period where God doesn't do that, which means what God told Adam is an achievable task. He really can manage the resources of the whole planet for the benefit of all life. But step one, you need a large population. Step two, you need to take inventory. You need to make sure the plants are well taken care of. Notice you see that in Genesis 1:30, where he says, green plants. All life feeds on green plants. So he's basically telling Adam, that's where you start. Take care of the green plants, because if you don't take care of the green plants, nobody gets to eat. So make sure they're well taken care of. And that's the first thing God had Adam do in the garden. Manage the garden. And he had him name all the animals. And he got to meet this creature. And you know the rest of the story. Okay.
He did that all.
Right, he did that over a period of time. In fact, I like some things that my wife and I have developed on that, where he said, well, you know, God made Eve in such a way that she automatically keeps the physical part of her life, the emotional part, the intellectual, and the spiritual part of her life in balance. Many designed to specialize. So we men have the capacity to be completely physically focused at one point in our life, completely spiritually focused at another point, or intellectually focused, and it bothers our wives terribly that we do that at times. But it's critical that someone in the family be able to do that. It's also critical that there be someone in the family that keeps things in balance, which is why God had to create Adam first. Adam needed to be trained on how to relate to this woman. And so Adam was given physical training, and then he was taught, introduced to the soulish creatures that would take care of the emotional part, the intellectual part, etc. And then and only then was he really ready to deal with this creature. Well, people put it this way. God equipped and trained Adam to relate to this woman. Who does it today? Mothers. They're the ones that are there to train and equip their sons to be able to relate to these strange creatures that they will meet. Well, he has to be brought up to speed before he begins to appreciate that there are creatures out there that need to have these things kept in balance in their life, and therefore, as a man, I need to make sure I spend some time in all these different areas. And so otherwise, I'm not going to be able to relate to this woman successfully at all. And all of us who are husbands have had experiences where we've seen the consequences where we don't do that. Okay? We're out of time. But we all know there's life after death. And one thing we didn't get into this passage, and we'll talk about this next week. What about this theme that we cannot plumb the depths of what God has revealed to us? Here we are in the 21st century. How little we have yet to figure out. Something we looked at when we were studying the book of Job. Remember Job 38? God asked Job and his friends 59 questions about science. How many can we answer today? 9 questions out of the 59. Well, Job and his friends couldn't answer any. But after 3,500 years, we're still getting an F on the test. So I think this is what Ecclesiastes has got to tell us about too. Father in heaven, we thank you that there is no way we can plumb the depths of your knowledge, of your wisdom, of your creativity, and of your love for us, and of your righteousness. But Father, thank you that you've given us the means to at least attempt to plumb those depths. And you've given us the command to do everything we can to learn about your righteousness and about your wisdom and your grace and love for each one of us. As we go through these creation texts, Lord, I pray that you continue to bless us with insights, with understanding, and with knowledge that we did not gain through the first several readings of these texts. Continue to bless us, Lord, that each one of us here would come away from this study knowing more about you and your plan of salvation, your righteousness, and your wisdom than we know now. I pray too, Father, that you give us opportunities this very week to share the good news of what we're learning and discovering for those that don't yet know you as Lord and Savior. And bless us, Lord, by bringing non-Christians into our lives who have been humbled by your Holy Spirit and are ready to receive this and take it into their hearts. In Jesus' name, amen.